In studio now I have Cormac Moore, historian and resident of the north central area of the Dublin City Libraries. As usual, good afternoon to you, Cormac.
Good afternoon, Noel.
Okay, now we're going to be talking about the War of Independence. And just before you came on, I was saying to you, like, when I went to school, which is we used to sort of talk about lots of things. As you said, you were saying there, corrected me a bit in primary school, but maybe in secondary school there was a lot more about it. But I used to get all the information, as I said to you as well. I loved libraries. I just loved them. I go into them all the time. But for me, as a kid, my beacon of knowledge was Pier Street Library, which is terrific. I'd recommend anyone to go over there, as well as our local library as well. Would it be true to say then, this is a long-winded way of saying, would it be true to say that a lot of people are quite unaware of the whole thing of the War of Independence? I mean, we talk about 1916 and all like that.
Yeah, yeah.
The War of Independence in 1919. How factual would it be in saying that?
I don't know. Like, I don't know what the numbers are, but I definitely do think to more people know about the Rising, all right, than the, you know, the War of Independence and the Civil War and so on. I know a lot of people have a good lot of information on the whole kind of Irish Revolution era. You know, it probably is the era that is of most interest to people.
Okay.
Having said that, though, the Rising definitely seems to stand out as the big event, when a lot of other big events happened, you know, a few short years later.
Well, when you think about the war, for what was it, from 1919, how long did it last?
Well, you could say the hostilities really lasted from, you know, beginning of 1919 to the truce in July 21.
Well, there you go. That's, 2 years?
2.5 years, pretty much.
1916 lasted 2 weeks, maybe.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. But obviously the Rising, what followed on from the Rising, led to the War of Independence and you know, the subsequent conflict. The Rising is a pivotal moment in Irish history in terms of how changing the mindset. But the War of Independence, you know, was a follow on from that. But it was longer. It was a lot more vicious. You know, it was on both sides. And we saw the partition of our country as well. You know, which happened during that era, which is the biggest legacy issue of this whole era of the Irish Revolution.
And what was happening from the 3 years, I know we're going to talk about just the War of Independence, but you know what happened between 1916 and 1919? What was happening? Was there any rumblings or...
Yeah, as we discussed in our, a few weeks ago, there was a lot of rumblings. It saw the rise of Sinn Féin. It saw the decimation of the Irish Parliamentary Party, which had been the dominant political party in Ireland, and it was absolutely destroyed by Sinn Féin in the general election of December 1918. So following on from that, the First Dáil met on the 21st of January 1919. Most of the people that should have been in the Dáil that were elected by from Sinn Féin were in prison, so only less than half met, about 30 met in the Mansion House in 1919. And on the very same day, the opening shots of the conflict, you know, from the paramilitary side of it, happened as well. Even though there had been some skirmishes beforehand, what is generally recognised as the opening shots of the War of Independence happened the very same day as the First Dáil met in Tipperary, Saledpeog in Tipperary, when two Irish RIC officers were ambushed and killed by Irish volunteers.
Well, is that a chicken and egg situation? What is a coincidence that it started on the same day that the First Dáil sat?
Yeah, it was a coincidence because the Sinn Féin, you know, politically did not support it. They actually condemned it. Actually, there was very little public support for the violence perpetrated against the RIC officers. They were actually very popular men. The two men were, like, one was from Cork, a 20-year-old from Cork, and one was, you know, 56-year-old widow from Mayo. So they were popular men, the RIC men. You know, they were killed by you know, 9 Irish volunteers, like Dan Breen and John Tracy led that thing. So there was no popular support for the violence. Now, the people who did commit the violence did believe that they were acting on behalf of the Irish people, who they believed voted for an Irish Republic in December, just literally less than a month earlier, over a month earlier. But there was no public support for violence. But the British, being the British, did what they always do, or have done at that time. They reacted badly, and they overreacted, not with the perpetrators. They couldn't catch the perpetrators, so they took it out in the public. And so what happened was, as 1919 went on, progressed, more people sided with the volunteers, you know, because they saw the British overreacting again, and that's what the British, it was really, really stupid policy by the British for that whole period, that they overreacted, they became vicious. The Republicans were vicious too, but in people's eyes, the British were way more vicious and way more brutal than the Republicans. So the public sided. By the end of 1919, beginning of 1920, the public started to go very much towards the volunteers.
Okay. It seems to be the mantra of the British right through history, even up to present day, you might say, in a lot of the things that they do. And when you say the war was very, very brutal, was it countrywide or was it concentrated in the cities?
No, it was country, certainly in certain areas. Like, there was a lot more violence in Dublin and in Munster than it would have been elsewhere around Ireland. And we'll talk a bit about partition later. And there was a lot of kind of sectarian civil violence in Belfast, probably more concentrated than in any place in Ireland at the time. But what happened was the last year of the conflict, from, you know, the summer of 1920 to the summer of 1921, was a particularly brutal war. Before that, it was a defensive war. So basically, the IRA, which the Irish Volunteers became known as during the War of Independence, they were looking for arms primarily. The only people they were really killing and were RIC officers. So the RIC were totally demoralised. People were leaving in droves. They were being killed or being attacked. So the British decided in the spring of 1920 to bring in extra help. So that's when the Black and Tans came in. And then the auxiliaries followed a few months later in the summer of 1920. And they obviously have achieved notoriety in Irish history for their brutal response to acts of violence by the IRA. And taking it out on innocent people, taking it out on cities. That's what sticks in the mind. If you were to look at kind of the more violent moments, like, you can look at Bloody Sunday, which happened in Dublin. You can look at the Kilmichael ambush. You can look at the sacking of Cork. You know, there's a lot of pretty vicious incidents that happened in Munster and Dublin in that year, from summer of 1920 to summer of 1921.
I was just reading in the paper the interest in the genealogy with a lot of people now with Who Do You Think You Are and all these sorts of programs. Yeah. And we can't do very much really because of the burning of the customs house there and all the records that were blown up around that time. Is that correct?
Yeah, well, it was the four courts in the Civil War. That's where the public records office.
Further on.
Yeah, the public records office actually were destroyed. Yeah.
Okay, but the customs house was burned. Yeah,
yeah. So what happened was it was guerrilla warfare primarily in the War of Independence. Now, De Valera, who was the president...
I was going to ask you, though, where was De Valera and Collins in all this?
Yeah, well, Collins led the kind of intelligence wing. You know, he was the primary military man in terms of the campaigns, the guerrilla warfare campaigns, and the intelligence gathering. So he played a pivotal role. Arthur Griffith claimed that he was the man who won the war during the treaty debates. You know, whether that's true or not, it's up for the debate, but he certainly was a pivotal figure in the military side of the... of the campaign, even though himself he didn't fight. You know, the only fighting he ever did really was in the Easter Rising. But he was a brilliant administrator, and he really had great contacts within Dublin Castle. He had a great intelligence network, and he had a first class brain, I suppose, to run the campaign the way he did. De Valera, on the other hand, he actually went to America to raise the profile of the Irish Republic and tried to get the American president to support Irish independence. So he was gone pretty much from the summer of 1919. To December 1920, so he wasn't there for a lot of the campaign, military campaign. When he did come back, he did see that the world opinion did not like guerrilla warfare. Yes, that was his opinion. So he would have preferred that there be one battle a month, 500 men up against each other at a time. And from that, you get the customs house attack. It was all of the Dublin IRA brigade were involved in that. And it was a disaster from a military perspective, in that over 100 people were captured. You know, there was quite a few people killed as well in the burning of the customs house. So it definitely did weaken the IRA in Dublin in particular.
Okay, and the first, we hear about the hunger strike later on in the 20th century, around the 80s with Bobby Sands and that, but we had Thomas McSweeney. Was he the first to do something like...
Well, there had been like hunger strikes before. You remember Thomas Ashe, we would have spoken about recently, he got force-fed during the hunger strike.
Oh yes, yeah, we talked about that last time.
Yeah, in 1917. So it was a ploy used, and it was used by suffragists as well. Tomix McSweeney struck a chord. You know, he was this kind of one man, you know, weak man up against the might of the empire. You know, and it definitely struck a chord, like with Indian nationalists, for example. It struck a chord with a lot of people in the world. But this one small man, he can take on the empire, and it was very, you know, poignant. His death, he was kind of a poetic man as well, and was able to voice his kind of opinions very clearly too. So it definitely struck a chord when he did die. And he was in a hunger strike for 74 days before he died, you know, so it was a long time.
Okay. And now we come up to partition, which started in 1921 in May, actually. And it was then sort of, we're talking about a lot of violence up in Belfast. So explain to me the transition from how it sort of moved around and how it came about with the partition.
Yeah, there had been a Home Rule Bill that was shelved because of World War One. There was a committee set up under Walter Long. He was considered the Irish expert in the British cabinet, even though he hadn't a clue about Irish affairs. His ignorance of Irish affairs was awesome, truly awesome, according to Michael Laffin, historian. He actually believed that Ireland, the Irish Republic, wanted to be the 49th state of America, which is absolute, you know, rubbish. But he still had a year of Lloyd George in the British cabinet, so he was tasked with setting up the Government of Ireland Act, which became law in December 1920. And the Government of Ireland Act partitioned Ireland into two, so six counties of Ulster, six of the nine counties of Ulster, and then the 26 counties of the southern. So there'll be two parliaments: Northern Parliament, Southern Parliament. But whilst this was going on, a lot of sectarian violence kind of sprung up, and it all happened in the summer of 1920 when many Catholic workers were kicked out of the Belfast shipyards. So there was a lot, and there was a lot of violence around that. So, like you're talking about between 400 and 600 people were killed in Belfast, most of them civilians, from summer 1920 to 1922. So it was a 2-year period, and it was particularly violent, particularly gruesome. But as this was happening, the partition came into being, you know. This is before the truce, before the treaty. A lot of people believe that the Anglo-Irish Treaty, the treaty, caused partition. It didn't. Partition came in before then. The opening of the Northern Ireland Parliament was in June 1921. And King George V, he opened the Parliament and asked for peace. And it was after that that a truce came about with Sinn Féin and the British. But the thing about partition and the Government of Ireland Act, it was accepted by very few people. It was ignored by Sinn Féin. It was ignored by a huge minority in the north of Ireland. You know, the Catholic minority completely rejected partition. So it was enacted in a kind of air of unreality. And it was totally unacceptable to most people in Ireland.
Okay. If I could sort of compare it to sort of Brexit, did a lot of people believe that's not going to happen? You know.
Yeah, there was a lot of confusion around it, you know, because not many countries had been partitioned before, so it was a very new concept. What is partition? You're literally cutting up a country.
East and West Germany, I mean.
There was no template really for partition. Yeah. There was very few templates for partition at the time. So how do you do this? So for example, all of the administration from Ireland was governed from Dublin. So that was the administrative centre. All the civil service departments were run from Dublin. A lot of all of the, you know, voluntary societies, all the churches were run on an all Ireland basis. So when the partition happened, all the civil service had to be cut in two, basically, you know. So you have an education department in south of Ireland, you have to have the north of Ireland. So it was a really confusing time. Most people didn't have much effect on people, really, until 1922. And then in 1923, when the customs barrier was brought in. Before then, people kind of ignored it. Like, most All-Ireland bodies remained All-Ireland bodies, and still are All-Ireland bodies.
But just going back to the War of Independence itself, had there been, when I said it was a country-wide, you were mentioning, like, yeah, it was, and it was a lot in Dublin, was there any up the north as well? Was there guerrilla warfare going up there as well?
Yeah, there was. Like the Northern IRA was often against loyalists, you know, and once the specials came into being in, you know, late 1920, there was a not necessarily a vigorous campaign, but there was an Northern IRA offensive. Mm-hmm. Not to the extent, though, that it was like the Sinn Féin did not have as much popularity in the north of Ireland as it has had in the rest of Ireland, electorally and on the ground. You know, so Sinn Féin have always been weak had always been weak up in the north of Ireland at that time.
Because it seems to me when you talk about the north and you talk about the royalists there, that sort of if you have what was happening down here, you had the revolutionaries fighting the British, but up there there was other factions coming into the equation as well.
Well, obviously a huge part of the population were pro-union, you know, unlike the rest of Ireland. So there was a huge chunk of the population that was against the activities of the rebels, should we say, the Irish Volunteers. So yeah, that was that factor. And they were armed and they were militant, and yet there was a lot of violence between both parties there.
Well, and then when you come up to the truce and the treaty negotiations, was it still in this sort of ambiguity when everything was decided as far as the public were concerned?
In terms of Ulster, you mean? Or
the whole country.
Yeah, well, you know, Ireland... The Irish, Sinn Féin wanted an Irish Republic. They wanted to have nothing to do with Britain, and they wanted unity as well. And the British wanted to make sure the empire was sacrosanct, and they wanted to make sure it's as solid as ever after this mess in Ireland. And they wanted to. The British always felt that they were weak on Ulster. They didn't have a good hand. And that's where the treaty negotiators didn't do a good job, in my opinion. You know, they were too focused on the crown, and they actually. They ignored or they didn't care about unity or the north of Ireland. They certainly didn't pay the attention that it deserved, and that's why we have the boundary, in my opinion, today that we may not have had if the treaty negotiators dealt with it better. And not just the treaty negotiators, but the anti-treaty side, like De Valera and you know, subsequently, they didn't focus much on the north either. It was all about the crown.
That you can see the effects.
Issue.
I mean, even now they're talking about boundaries and all that sort of carry on with Brexit and what's going to happen there. So it's raising its ugly head again.
Yeah.
So Michael Collins heavily involved in the treaty, but how did that come about?
So the big, well, probably the biggest, one of the biggest questions in Irish history is why didn't De Valera go himself to the treaty negotiations? Now, he had been, when the truce happened, he had a series of meetings with Lloyd George in London, but the two of them didn't get on very well. You know, I think Lloyd George has famously said that negotiating with De Valera is like picking up mercury with a fork. He couldn't get anything from De Valera. And Lloyd George was considered, and rightly so too, as probably the most skilled negotiator in Europe. This guy was cunning, very clever. You know, he always was able to get his way. The two of them didn't hit it off. Like, De Valera was obstinate, and Lloyd George just wasn't able to get through to him, wasn't able to get his way with him. So it was decided, and then they broke up in the summer of 1921, those talks, and they were kind of have megaphone diplomacy, you know, giving out about each other, or, you know, saying various different things about each other for a number of months. Then they decided to meet up, have a conference, which happened in London, in Downing Street, from October to December 1921. And De Valera sent a delegation over, headed by Arthur Griffith, but also with Michael Collins. They're the two heavyweights.
Okay.
His reasoning, you can take or leave it, presidents don't negotiate with prime ministers. People had seen what had happened to Woodrow Wilson during the Treaty of Versailles, that he was conned by people like Lloyd George and Clemenceau in France. He also believed that, you know, he was going to send over a moderate like Arthur Griffith, and if Griffith couldn't come up with an agreement, which De Valera didn't think would happen, then surely, you know, the British were unreasonable, you know, they tried their best. He also believed he had to take care of the extreme elements at home. He was best equipped to do that, and he was. He had the ear of everyone, pretty much, on the Irish side, whereas Collins had a very fractious relationship with people like Cottle Broome in particular.
It sounds like a tenuous basis for any kind of negotiation, doesn't it? Like, that everyone would still seem to be sort of, I don't know, I won't use the word half-heartedly, but not really sure of what grounds they were going on. And at that time, now, how well up was Lloyd George on Irish relations and the whole structure of Ireland at that time? Was he well informed?
I don't know how well he knew, because I doubt if he did know that much, to be honest, because the Irish had a very united front, you know, publicly anyway. It was only once the treaty debates happened and the actual treaty was signed, that it came out in the open, this public split. Say people like Richard Mulcahy and Cottle Brewer had a vicious relationship with each other, you know, throughout the War of Independence. So I would say that Lloyd George wouldn't have had as much intel as he would have liked. But he knew what he wanted, you know. He knew what he wanted, and he knew how to play people off each other. So he knew who the kind of moderates in the treaty negotiation team were, and he knew who the ones who weren't going to give an inch. So what he did was he sidelined them, and he only negotiated with people who, before the treaty negotiations, people thought Collins was a hardliner. It was transparent he wasn't, you know, he was more willing to negotiate and to come up with a compromise.
Yeah, the reason I asked that question is because, I mean, obviously he couldn't have known the consequences of it, and it was something new. It was new ground. That's the reason why I asked, like, how well informed he was as regards the Irish and the whole political structures of the way things were and were going to be. I mean, as you say, it was new ground for them. It was a virgin ground for them. So,
well, it wasn't virgin ground of Lloyd George negotiating, and this guy knew how to negotiate.
No, I mean about what would happen.
I don't know if he knew a civil war was going to happen, he knew what he wanted. For, like, his main task was to get the best solution for his people, the British people, you know. So he, that's what he did, you know, and that was his job. You know, I don't know if he knew that there was going to, you know, there's going to be a civil war from it, you know. I think he thought.
No, I'm thinking about, you know, the relationship actually with the North and what sort of maybe underground negotiations going on, or was it just a case of the British wanting to hold on to as much as they could and knowing this is all they were going to get themselves? It's you know, it's pretty ambiguous to the extent. I mean, as you were saying there, a different way of living up the North at the time. I imagine religion had a different connotation than it did down south, I imagine, as well.
Yeah, well, look, obviously, look, most people up north were Protestant, you know, compared to most people down south being Catholic. But I would say that, like, Lloyd George always felt his weakest hand was in Ulster, you know, and many people believe that what they'd have to do in Ulster is, like, kind of carve up the Government of Ireland Act, even though the Ulster Unionists were totally opposed to that, but also, you know, look at it from a county voting option, which meant that each county up in the north could vote in or out of Northern Ireland or Southern Ireland, which would probably have meant that four counties would have been Northern Ireland, which would have been Antrim, Armagh, Down and Derry. And then the other two counties, Tyrone and Fermanagh, wouldn't have been. They would have voted to be in South. That was the British were very weak hand. But what happened was that, as I said, Lloyd George was so cunning, was so skilled in negotiations, he sidelined Arthur Griffith, and he got Arthur Griffith to agree to a boundary commission, that a boundary commission would be established, which would determine what would be the size and of Northern Ireland, you know, which parts would remain in Northern Ireland, which would go back to the South, and also which parts would remain in Southern Ireland and go into Northern Ireland. So Arthur Griffith agreed to this alone without consulting the rest of the delegation. He gave a verbal agreement that he wouldn't break up the treaty talks based on Northern Ireland if he got a boundary commission. So Lloyd George literally threw that in his face on the very night that they signed the treaty by saying, you promised to do this.
Yes, yeah.
And Arthur Griffith had forgotten about it because it was a few weeks beforehand.
Yeah.
And he said, oh, actually, I did say that. Sorry about that. So the rest of the delegation were disgusted with Griffith, but they still signed anyway. Signed the treaty.
How long did the negotiations go on for?
Just under 2 months. So from, I think, 11th of October to 6th of December was the time. So yeah, just under 2 months. But as I said, what Lloyd George did, he sidelined. He knew the guys he could get on with, like Arthur Griffith and Collins, but he couldn't get on with people like Childers or George Gavin Duffy or Robert Barton, people like that. So he sidelined him and just negotiated with, so they had as many meetings as possible without all of the delegation and with the key players of Griffith and Collins.
Okay. So, and of course, Collins famously said he just signed his death warrant.
Exactly, yeah. And look, he was dead 9 months later, so yes, he was correct in saying that, you know.
Okay, and just to, I know we're going to be talking more about other things carrying on from that, but the immediate reaction when they came back, what was the immediate reaction, say, in the first week or two?
Well, it depends who you spoke to, but a lot of people were relieved. You know, they wanted peace more than anything. Like, the establishment, if you consider the establishment of the church, you know, the business, media, you know, business classes, they were very happy. You know, they were mainly in favour of the treaty. However, you know, key elements of the Republican movement and within the army as well, the Irish volunteers, were not happy with it. Okay. We'll obviously talk more about that, in our next discussion.
Okay, and that brings us nicely up to the break, Cormac. Thank you very much, and for putting up with part of my ignorance on a lot of the subject there. But thank you very much. And that's Cormac Moore, historian in residence from the North Central area with Dublin City Libraries. And do advise you, there's great history in the libraries.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And you mentioned Pearse Street Libraries. It's fantastic a resource. You know, there's even, you know, if you can't make it in for whatever reason, there's a great digital depository as well now that's available. So you can see loads of great images from this era.
Go into the library. library, Cormac.
But go into the library. It is a great library. You know, it's wonderful.
And when you go upstairs, like it's
the reading room upstairs. It's great archives. Yeah. You've got all the Dublin City Council meetings. You've got theatre archives. You've got good sporting archives. Like it is a wonderful library. Mm.
It's a great asset to in any city as well, in any community, is the library itself. I mean, I'm not just picking out Pier Street just because it'd be very, but all libraries, just go in, sit down. The feeling of solitude going in and just sitting down and reading and looking through lots of stuff, going to find something that you like.
And it's easier to kind of browse in libraries, you know, and actually look for stuff if you're doing projects or whatever. Like it might seem a bit daunting if you haven't done it before, but staff are always very helpful, and it actually is very easy to start searching and start looking at you know, areas of interest to you. And once you do, you won't stop going back.
Yeah, and I'm delighted to say and hear all the time that reading, actually holding a book in your hand, is coming back into favour.
Yes, me too.
It's great.
Yeah.
It's absolutely terrific. I've
never had a Kindle myself, you know.
Neither have I. Yeah.
I can see some benefits to it, but I always just like having that physical book in my hand.
It's absolutely great, yeah. And of course, just to mention as well, the libraries, they are updated. They've all things to do with technology within the libraries, as well as the basic book reading and all that, haven't they?
Oh, yeah. Like they've access to a lot of resources you wouldn't be able to get, or you'd have to pay heavy subscriptions yourself for, you know, like access to newspaper databases, magazines online. You know, they've a huge range of resources available online and in the library, or when you sign up, you can get access to them from home as well. There's loads of options. Like, they're a wealth of information, as you would expect from a library.
Okay, Cormac, thank you very much, and look forward to talking to you again.